To all the wanderers,
wanderers,
free thinkers,
and throwaway kids,
welcome to the dumpster fire.
Let's get dumpster diving.
We're live. Ella, how's your day going?
It goes pretty well. How about you?
That's going good. Going all right. Justin, how about you?
Doing well.
So, what are we sipping on today, Brian?
Well, it's a bit uninspired because, you know, we just did this, but this was my thinking. We're actually trying that Benchmark Full Proof direct from the bottle. It's 125 proof. This is my plan with this. This Benchmark whiskeys are, I think they're a really good buy. It's the Buffalo Trace side brand. There's like five of them. So the one we had, the single barrel, is the highest line of it. This is a step down, and then I think they have three more. And we'll just go through them and see how comparable they are.
Sounds good.
This, okay. This smells very similar. On a new thing, limiting myself on alcohol now. I'm trying real hard to get to a goal weight by the 9th. And I think that more than likely the alcohol was, it shuts your liver down. And we'll talk a little more about this later. But you don't really burn calories like you would when you're on alcohol, even though hard alcohol has no real calories.
So. Right.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, that is very strong.
Yeah, it is.
It's great, though. Yeah, it's the same.
It's got a good flavor.
It's the same. I can't tell a huge difference between this and the single barrel.
It's Ella approved.
Yeah. These are a bargain. Even this is actually a bit cheaper than the single barrel I bought. And they go down from there. I think the cheapest bottle is like $12.99.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Then it may be terrible. We'll find out when we get there.
A journey of bourbons.
Yes. So, real quick, I mean, things are going really good as far as this podcast goes. Everybody on our Facebook page, thank you guys so much. I really hope you're enjoying that. I mean, we've only had it around for a while, and I think it's spreading. We got a lot of feedback on that. We are going to do an episode coming very soon that was requested. We'll probably start another poll. We're thinking of some more ways to interact with everybody. So just thank everyone so much. I hope you're listening to this, and I hope I hope it's benefiting your life and making you feel included. So,
Yeah, we really want to make it a place for people to come together and be creative and be free to have discussions and conversations.
Yeah.
So let's keep doing that.
Yeah.
And if you notice, it says moderator between three of our names, but we don't spend a lot of time moderating. So we expect everybody to kind of self-police and just keep kind of the true feeling of the dumpster fire going in that group as well.
Yeah, please don't get us kicked off Facebook, guys.
Yeah.
So far, we've had to do no deletions, nothing. Everything's worked itself out.
Self-policing has done good so far.
We want to keep it as apolitical as possible. Mm-hmm. And just keep it deep conversations, funny stuff. We're okay with all that. It's just we want to keep it out of the political sphere. This is kind of a place for you guys to get a break from politics.
Absolutely.
And we don't want to see that tribalism and arguments pop up in our page like you do on just about every other page. So we want to keep it something different. So something a little weird and a little funny. Mm-hmm. And keep it interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the vibe has conveyed, because anytime that even started, it kind of ended its own self.
We've
never stepped in, never any of that. So
we're all big proponents of self-governance. Mm-hmm. We all believe that we can govern ourselves, and we can believe that for you guys. So just try to abide by the golden rule there. Treat everybody the way you'd want to be treated, and mm-hmm. Keep it interesting, keep it fun, and let your weird light shine.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we got a great crowd. So just talking a little bit before we started, and today what we're going to talk about are dreams. Now, I know Justin has some very interesting dreams that he's brought up in the past. I think we'll probably get a little bit more into that. But what really is very interesting is that recently they have found out that dreams are a little more than they thought, and that they can manage to communicate in dreams. I think they're one of the most crazy things that happen to us. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before.
I think it's interesting that we live this entire life while we're sleeping. Mm-hmm. Most of your dreams you never remember, and most evidence points to that's because it was a Monday day of dreaming, yeah. Mundane. We don't remember every day in our waking life, so why would we remember every dream if nothing spectacular happened? We tend to only really remember our dreams when it is something out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to think about. You're having this whole other life inside your head that you're not fully aware of. And I'd really like to explore that a little bit today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we talked a little bit, and all of us have somewhat of a recurring dream. I've experienced night terrors.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I have not experienced that in a long time, but I have one that really stands out. Yeah. So I'll get into that. But I think Ella's are the most consistent. So if you want to go ahead and start, this is not a great story, but very interesting.
So I have three dreams that I can recall from pre-pubescent Ella's, memoir. So basically, the first one, I kind of want to preface with, I had a really great relationship with my mom when I was younger, so this wasn't some type of trauma. And I say that because my mom, in some way, shape, or form, is the star of this nightmare. And I don't want to make it seem like my mom was this horrible mother. We had a great relationship when I was a child. We still do. But in my dream, I would wake up, and all of my family this took place in my home, my childhood home, that my mother still lives in. All of my family's in the living room watching TV. I want to go from my bedroom to them to be with them. To get from my bedroom to the living room where they are, you have to turn right out of my bedroom and then go down a hallway and then turn right and you're in the living room. Now the shape of my hallway. There is a room at the end of the hallway. I was the second to last door. I was the last door on the left. There was a door before mine, and then on the other side was the bathroom, and then like a hallway closet. And it was a custom-built house for these people back, I want to say, in the 50s. And my parents had bought this house in the 70s, so it wasn't just a regular closet. You actually would move the coats out of the way, and the closet went really deep.
Yeah, it's very weird.
Really deep. Yeah, great spot to hide for when you have people over that don't know that, and you're playing hide-and-go-seek.
Mm-hmm.
So in the dream, I knew something was wrong, but I had to get to my family. So I remember I would try to get past that closet, and without missing a beat, every time that closet would open, and a variation of my mother would come out that was this mummified, ghostly thing, and almost like a potato sack, like the real ragged on the bottom, like it's been tattered.
Yeah.
So just like the generic brown, like nightgown-ish. Random, almost looked kind of like dried out like the Crypt Keeper. I knew it was my mom, did not look like my mom, but for some reason that was my mom. No legs, so it was a ghost, but then roller skates. I remember it had roller skates that would kind of dangle when it would attack me. And every time ghost, mummy, demon, roller skate mom would get me, I would wake up. So I never got to my family. So that was a dream I had constantly. And I remember even feeling guilty as a kid because I was like, why am I dreaming that my mom is like this evil ghost mummy thing? So that was one. Another one, very much more simple. I watched Pet Sematary as a child, and it scarred me for life. So the patient, I can't think of his name, the young college guy that gets hit by the bus, he goes and at one scene he's talking to Doc and says, Doc, I know you're not asleep. Doc then gets up, goes to the cemetery, wakes up the next day, thinks it's a dream, pulls the covers back, his feet are muddy. So he actually walked with the ghost. In my dream, it would be his creepy voice going, Ella, Ella, I know you're not asleep. And I would sit upright in bed, and my vocal cords would be constricted, and I would be screaming at the top of my lungs for my mom, and I'd be like, ah, and nothing but like a raspy whisper would come out, and I would just like shiver under the covers until I could pass back out. And then the third one was, again, in my house, Lou Ferrigno as the Incredible Hulk. So, again, being that kind of odd, custom-built 1950s house, my living room connected to the dining room and the kitchen, but all three rooms weren't, there was like walls, because, this was an open concept back then. But they had a giant window built in between the kitchen and the dining room. So you could serve food from the kitchen into the dining room without having to take the extra three steps and actually walk around the stove and get to the dining room. So we, our dining room table at the time was one giant central post, but then four legs at the bottom that had like black tenderly, wired tenderly things, accents, and this big like black wood laminate octagonal top. So that was our family dining room table. And in my dream, I'm hiding under that table and I'm watching The Incredible Hulk on our black and white 13-inch TV that was in the dining room, because that's how long ago this was. And I see my family making orange Jell-O through that window. And I'm like five or so at the time. In my five-year-old mind, I'm like, why are they making orange Jell-O? Who likes orange Jell-O? That is disgusting. Like, and I'm pissed because they're not making red Jell-O. They're making orange Jell-O. Yeah. So, I mean, I even remember, this is how crazy it is. In the dream, I always remembered smelling the orange Jell-O powder when it was poured into the bowl. And, like, I was mad in my dream, so I'm pouting. Well, Lou Ferrigno comes out of the TV and starts to strangle me, and my legs are dangling. He's got both hands around my neck as the Hulk. I'm, like, choking to death, and I'm trying to make any noise I can because I'm just, like, screaming for my family to look up. Just look up, and they'll see the Incredible Hulk strangling me, and they can save me. And then I would always wake up. My family never saved me. So those are my three reoccurring nightmares that happened well before puberty. I can honestly say that I didn't have them after puberty. So that is kind of a walk into my demented mind.
It's funny because I did a little loose study in high school for a class. I can't even recall which class, but I wrote a paper on dreams. And I asked over 80 fellow students if they remembered a reoccurring dream pre-puberty that ended right around puberty. And something like 76 out of 80 all had a prepubescent reoccurring dream or nightmare, I myself had a reoccurring dream. It's pretty surreal. It's nothing I could quite explain. I don't think I could explain it for y'all. But I remember it being very intense, and it was reoccurring. I mean, it was a nightly thing for many, many years. But it ended around puberty. I know yours, Brian, yours was post-puberty.
So yes.
If you want to tell us about that.
So I cannot recall any reoccurring dreams pre-puberty. But I do remember one that happened probably around 18 to into my 20s. And in talking about this, it is a lucid dream because I have complete control in the dream. Yeah. And I'm actually fighting with my own self, saying what's happening is not possible.
Yeah.
So all these dreams start out extremely boring.
Yeah.
I'm doing a normal thing during the day. But somehow during this span, I realize that I can fly. There's no weight to my body. I can move freely.
That's awesome.
And in that, like I said, I've had this multiple times. The last couple times I had it, I remember I would be like, I don't want to wake up from this. This is amazing.
Yeah.
There's just total freedom here.
Yeah, why would you want to wake up from
that? Yeah, and they've never been anything bad in them. Like I said, all of them are always mundane. I'm never a superhero. I'm never doing anything. It's kind of like how I guess that would really work. Just one day you realize you can do something impossible.
Yeah.
And, you know,
thinking, I definitely would not use that power for good.
I don't know what I would do with it.
I would be very selfish. I mean, like, I would like to think, like, I wouldn't necessarily go out of my way to not help somebody with my power, but I would be very selfish. Like, I would be flying to private islands and being like, suckers! Like, yeah.
Well, that's the peculiar thing. I guess I never hashed it out any further than I was like, hey, I can just float.
Yeah.
And be weightless. So I never wanted to, I guess I never got the grandeur of wanting to like see how high I could go or anything like that. It's very weird. But I mean, maybe that would have came later if I'd continued to have that dream. I kind of think that was probably because during that time, I regained a lot of control of my life. I was in college at that time, which seemed impossible to start. Yeah. I was awful in high school.
Yeah.
I went like for 2 weeks. I don't know how I graduated.
Yeah.
But then I got into IU. I got into IU Bloomington. I had some real good friends there, so that was cool. I'm guessing that probably had a lot to do with it, but if you asked me before this, are you a lucid dreamer? I would have said no. I do know I dream in color. Yeah. I can tell you that because there's specific dreams where I remember like the woods being extra green and all this. And I know some people say they can't remember any color from their dreams.
Yeah.
That is so odd to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I can tell you I've never dreamt in black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me neither.
Yeah, interesting. So that's the good side of my dreaming. The more negative side is I have had some night terrors, and two of them stand out very big because I would call them a lucid night terror. I mean, everybody's kind of had the thing where you wake up, you can't quite move, you think something's beside you and stuff.
You're paralyzed.
Yeah, I understand what that is, the old hag. I mean, this is a common concept. It happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, I've had that before too, probably all the way up into my 30s.
Yeah.
I'd had a couple of those. Usually when I would come home and be really tired, take a nap, have something on my mind I needed to get up for, you have that trouble transitioning from sleep to awake.
Yeah.
Your body dumps sleep hormones. That's how that works. These two are quite a bit different. The first one happened in my apartment in Bloomington. I was living with a friend of ours at the time. And I had a set of Boston computer speakers I would play music on every night when I went to bed. And Bloomington wasn't, you know, an apartment complex. It's not the quietest, you know. Yeah. People are moving around and stuff. So that was just a habit I got in. So the weirdest thing about this is I wake up to roll over, and the speakers sound muffled.
Really?
And I'm like, okay, this is kind of weird. I roll over and look, and there's a person standing between me and the speakers that are on my computer desk.
Really?
And I look at this person. They're just a black figure. And I blink my eyes, and I'm like, someone broke into our apartment, and they disappear, and the speakers sound normal.
That's bizarre.
Within a blink. So, yeah, that, and then what was very strange is my roommate around this same time jumped out of his bed because he dreamed that a man walked into his room and dropped a spider on him.
Really?
It was right around the same time, yeah.
That's odd. What was his description of the man versus your description?
I don't think he has one. It's just a black figure came up, leaned over him, dropped a spider on his chest, and he jumped out of bed. He actually jumped out of bed.
Wow, that's
crazy. I was fully awake for that because I literally sat there for a minute listening to the music thinking, what the heck just happened?
Yeah.
And so that one was, I don't think I was really scared about that. I've kind of freaked out a little thinking someone's in our apartment, you know?
Yeah.
But afterwards, I was like, that was really weird, you know, that I don't know how to make sense of this. No spider got dropped on me. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
The second one happens at a different apartment later on. And I remember this is another time I came home from class. I was tired. I laid down, took a nap on the couch. So I'm napping on the couch. I vividly remember sitting up from the couch, getting a weird feeling, standing up and looking around the room. And I look over into a corner that was the hallway to the two bedrooms in our house.
Yeah.
And there's a black, like, hairball that looks like it's moving, and like almost like a black hole, like you can see into it. And I thought, what the heck is this? And it makes like a baby cry, but it's one note, and it gets so loud, it just keeps escalating in volume. And I woke up, and I was
terrified
of that. I'm getting goosebumps talking about this.
Yeah.
I've never made sense of that one. I don't know what input I could have had at that time
that
would have made me dream that up even.
Yeah.
So that one was really, really strange. During the day, it was daylight when I woke up. The weirdest thing is I'm standing up when that happens. I remember being like, oh my God. And then I open my eyes and I'm on the couch laying down.
Yeah.
That was disorienting.
Yeah.
So,
And your proprioception's all thrown off.
Yeah.
Whether you're standing or laying.
Yeah. And I immediately got up and looked in that corner.
It's kind of odd because in shamanistic traditions, most tribal societies across the globe view dreams as visions and believe that you are all actually crossing over into the spirit realm.
Yeah.
And it's kind of odd that you and your roommate in the same apartment would both have this dark figure visiting you.
Yes.
Pretty interesting.
I'm going to, and I will get a hold of him after this and actually ask him if he remembers this.
Him
he had his, the girl that he later married at the time was with him.
Yeah.
She's actually the one that told me it happened, and then he explained what happened.
Yeah.
So I had not told him a word about what happened to me because I was like, you know, it's just a weird dream. But afterwards, I was like, okay.
I think all of us have had dreams that in some aspect came true, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've had several recurring dreams over the years. I actually just had a recent spout of them in the last 2 years. I had some odd ones in my early 20s. I was having apocalyptic dreams. The world is ending, but each one was completely different from the last. I remember the first one. I had the house to myself, which was rare. I was still living at home with my mom. I was maybe 19. And I had fallen asleep in our living room across from this big bay window in our living room. And the dream took off where reality ended. I'm laying there trying to fall asleep, and I look out the bay window, and there's a field across the street from our house. And there's a giraffe in the field. And I'm like, that giraffe doesn't belong there. Then I notice there's a tiger in the field. And as I look, more and more creatures that don't belong in southern Indiana are in this field. And then I hear a screech, and they all take off running. I hear a bird screech, and I see birds fill the sky. They all take off running. And I look from where they're running from, and I'm like, oh, it's the end of the world. And the sky literally just split open, and I woke up.
Wow.
And I kept on having reoccurring dreams that were very similar to that, all in different settings, all were different triggers for the apocalypse, or different reasons why I figured it out. It is the apocalypse. But I had those for several years. Now, I did have an interesting string of reoccurring dreams just last year and the year before. I had five of them that I know of. I was trying to journal them, but I'm not very good at remembering to do that first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
But the first one I remember in great detail. I woke up in someone else's body. I knew everything about this person as though I was them. I had no recollection of me. I was this person.
Right.
I had all of their memories. I knew everything about their life. I knew where they worked, what they did, what their dreams, their hopes, everything, as though I was them. I was British. I was in my early 20s. I wake up next to a very beautiful young woman, a half black girl that I knew as my fiance. I get up for work, I'm running a little bit behind, and she like playfully tries to pull me back into bed, and I kind of fight her off, so I go, oh, I gotta go, baby, I gotta go. I get ready for work, she even helps me tie my tie, I was never good at tying ties. I get ready for work, and I remember thinking how much I hate my job. I was just in data entry, and I remember thinking how below me I felt this job was. It's just a lame, boring office job.
Right.
And I go to work. I spend 8 hours at work literally doing data entry. I knew how to do the job. I hated it. It was mind-numbing. I had friends at work. I go and eat lunch with a buddy. We're telling bad jokes and stuff. Then I had to take the train into work, and then at the end of the day I took the train home. I'm on the train and some gentleman taps me on the shoulder and asks me if I know the time, and I pull out my phone, I look at it, and I turn to tell him the time, and there's a pistol in my face, and he pulls the trigger. I felt my body drop before I heard the bang, which is pretty realistic, and then I see blood pooling around my horizontal body, like I can still see through my own eyes. I can see the blood filling in my vision, and I could hear the pandemonium, but it sounded more and more distant. And as I faded away and felt myself dying, I was coming back to my own body. This had happened five times, five different lives, and it was always a mundane day. It was like I was experiencing these people's last day on the planet. And I was talking to a friend about it. And he's like, man, that's intense.
That's deep.
He is like, so deep. He really believes. He was like, I don't know, man, but it sounds like, because I don't fear death. I haven't feared death in a long time. I don't fear my own mortality. And he believes that because I don't fear death, that I was literally being sent to other people to experience their last day on the planet because they wouldn't be able to handle it.
Right.
I was there to handle it for them so they could transition more easily.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of a, I don't know, kind
that's
of an
beautiful
odd psychopomp, sin-eater type thing, I guess.
Yeah.
That is a creepy yet beautiful way to look at it.
Yeah.
It was definitely very interesting.
Well, that leans forward, you know, now they're finding that they're communicating with people inside dreams.
Yeah.
So there's there very well could be something to this. You know, you talk about DMT. You release a little DMT generally when you dream. They think that's why.
Yeah.
That's how it operates. And you've actually ridden that all the way out. You
know, yeah.
When you look at the studies on that, I believe it's Rick Strassman. When he started his study, he was actually studying melatonin.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is now probably one of the most common things you can get. Well,
yeah.
he found out that the melatonin wasn't the trigger. It was the DMT.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did those experiments, Rick Strassman and Terrence McKenna, I get those two mixed up.
Yeah.
When they did those experiments, they found that people experienced the same similar things, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
So there is, I mean, there's some kind of function here.
Yeah, that we don't fully grasp.
That we don't grasp.
I think it'll be many, many years. I think we have to understand the brain better before we'll fully grasp it. But that study that was done, this is according to sciencemagazine.org.
Mm-hmm.
There was a study done in four different countries. It was Germany, the Netherlands, the U.S., and France, where they had 36 people in total that they studied. They taught them how to lucid dream, which mm-hmm. I didn't even realize you could be taught to.
Yeah.
But they went through, all 36 of them reported no lucid dreaming in their past. All 36 of them were trained to lucid dream and ways to trigger themselves to take control over the dream. And then they were taught, before they would go under, they were all given 56 sleep studies over a couple of years. And before they would go under, they'd be taught signals, ways to answer questions, yes and no answers, mathematical equation answers. And it was all through eye movement or tapping of their finger or vocalizing. And only 18% of the people answered the questions correctly. Another 16% didn't answer it correctly. And 60% just didn't answer. So it's a very small percentage that they were actually able to communicate with. But the fact that we saw it on four different labs on four different countries,
yeah.
that every one of them had a small percentage that were able to do this, that's proof of concept.
Yeah.
We now know that it can happen. Mm-hmm. Now, it's difficult. It is very difficult. It requires training of the brain. But the fact that we can incept someone, that
yeah,
we can
it's
communicate.
Inception. It's the movie Inception.
Yeah, that we can communicate within their dream, that's pretty intense to me. And
wild.
I think we're going to learn a lot over the next 20 years. I really feel like we're coming to a precipice of knowledge. And knowledge hits these precipices. It hits them, and then there's an epiphany, and then we have more questions that need to be answered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're just about to hit another big precipice, another plateau,
yeah.
Before a bunch of more questions get asked. I think we're going to understand consciousness a little better in the next 20 to 50 years. I think we're right at the edge of something. We're starting to understand not only with our own minds, but like interdimensional travel, things of that nature.
Yeah.
And I think all those things are linked. I really do. My experience with DMT, I'm not a person that believes unless you show me. I was shown other dimensions, and I really feel like the brain might be the key to mm-hmm. interdimensional travel. I mean, I don't know. I'm not that smart, for one. I can't do that level of math.
Right.
And no one truly knows right now, but I do believe in possibilities, and I can only go with my own experiences and things I've researched, things I've studied, but I really think there's some sort of link there.
There is, yeah.
So... but yeah, the mind's a fascinating place, and just the idea that we run around our subconscious all night is
yes.
just fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Dreams are a fascinating thing, and I would like for you guys to go on the Facebook page and let us know a dream you had that came true.
Yeah,
or an
we'll make
aspect.
A post.
And we'll make a post about it, because I want to get some interaction from you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get your guys' feedback on stuff and let us know you're listening.
Yeah. So. Again, my past, I was, you know, not the best kid.
Yeah.
I was not a bad kid. Yeah. I cared about everyone, you know, but I was skipping school. I was being wild.
Yeah.
I remembered this while we're talking. My friend had actually had a dream that we got arrested. And I was like, we don't do anything illegal. I did
yeah.
not drink till I was 18 years old. I didn't want to get my parents in
yeah.
trouble.
Yeah.
I was that kid. So he had had this dream, and he said that there was a black girl in the back seat with us. And we didn't even, I mean, we're in... rural Indiana. We didn't even know anybody that
yeah.
it was, you know,
would fit that description.
Yeah, that would fit it at all. But he said that we got pulled over and the cops arrested us. So later on, he had told me about this dream more than once. I'll never forget this. We'd made friends with an actual black guy that we were friends with, and his, I believe, sister was hanging out with us.
That's so funny.
We go to pick up some friends of ours from a party, mm-hmm. and the police are in the road. And we're like, what's going on? You know, you stop for the police.
Yeah.
Well, they ask us if we were out there the night before, and I was like, yeah, I dropped people off, and they arrest us. And Mike is sitting there telling me, because I knew this was going to happen. We weren't in any trouble in the long run. Well, I mean, we didn't do anything wrong, but I guess the cops didn't know that, so they just took us to jail.
Predicted it.
Yeah.
I actually had a friend in middle school that she moved to Jennings County in the 7th grade, and we instantly, from her first day in class, became inseparable. I had noticed her in the lunchroom and just walked over and started talking to her, and we were inseparable. We did everything together. And we're friends all the way through the middle of 8th grade. And I had this very complex dream that she disappeared, that she quit coming back to school. That was on a Sunday. Monday morning, she wasn't there. She had moved over the weekend to Ohio without... She didn't even know she was moving.
Wow.
Her mom had moved them in the middle of the night. I only knew that. I did not know what had happened until a month later she sent me a letter. She had gotten my address somehow, and we became pen pals for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I completely predicted that happening.
Yeah.
And I was horrified because she's my best friend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I came back to school and she wasn't there. And I kept on asking everybody. No one could tell me anything.
Oh, wow.
And it took a month to find out what had happened. Her mom had left an abusive relationship in the middle of the night.
That's exactly what I was thinking happened.
Yeah. She moved him in the middle of the night. That girl didn't even know she was moving. And I did.
Wow.
Apparently. It was very odd. But I think we've all got some sort of intuition that... I think every one of us have that.
Yep.
I think everyone's had an experience like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never really, I don't think, had a dream, per se. But, like, I remember, and so we're going in the Wayback Machine when I was about 17. So about 17 years ago, I was laying in bed, and the phone rang, and it woke me up. So I remember being awake, and for some reason, the phone rang. This was just your standard generic cordless, you know, house phone. You didn't have specific rings for specific people or anything. And I remember thinking it was, this is this specific ex-boyfriend. And I don't know why I thought that. I literally hadn't talked to him in months. I mean, like, I hadn't been thinking about him. There was nothing that made me, you know, made it seem like he would even be around. And I picked up the phone and it was him. And I just remember being like, why are you calling me? There's no reason, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty much gave just like a very short kind of tell-off. Phone call, but hung it up, and I was like, how did I know that was going to be him?
Mm-hmm. I think we've all done this, where we've had a very close friend, or even a boyfriend or girlfriend, where, especially back in the days before cell phones, where we went to call that person, and they're already on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
The phone hasn't even
I've absolutely
yet.
Done that.
We do that to this day. Ryan and I do that to this day.
Yeah.
And I think the more proximity with that person, the longer you're around them, it's like you get on the same brainwave.
Mm-hmm.
It literally is. To where you can literally predict what the person's going to say next, or what they're going to do. And it borders on that supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
We just did that. I picked the phone up to call Ella, and it rang. It was her. I told her, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. It happens pretty often when you get really close with someone. I think there's more to our cognition than we understand. I really do. I mean, we've proven that the brain does map 360
mm-hmm.
degrees all around you. That 3-foot bubble that we always talk about,
mm-hmm.
That exists. Our brains are mapping. We do not understand the mechanism. We don't understand. Most people think it's electromagnet, some sort of electromagnetic field that's 3 foot around us. But we've proven, without a shadow of a doubt, through multiple studies, that you can put an object behind someone and they have no known ability of knowing that it's there, but parts of their brain will light up,
mm-hmm.
saying that they know something.
When you can sense someone walk up behind you.
Yeah, yeah, and we've all had the feeling of someone's eyes on us.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an odd psychological thing. I was friends with a girl in high school that I didn't believe it at first. She said being pointed at felt like it tickled. And I said, that's not possible. And I could literally point at her in the hallway, be 20 feet away from her, and her back to me, and she would start wiggling. It was the oddest thing.
Wow.
She was an odd girl, but I abused that. I think I broke her of it.
You broke her ability.
Because I just point.
You stole her superpower.
Yeah.
It's like synesthesia.
Yeah, it really is.
And they know that's real. That blow, I look into that, and I'm like, there's no way. But they've proven
that.
Synesthesia is when you're... What you experience, like colors, sounds, they get mixed up. Yeah. So people they'll say they can taste a color and it's consistent.
That's what most psychedelics do for you, is cause synesthesia, because it breaks down your facilitated pathways. So neurons that would not normally talk start talking to one another.
Okay.
So you'll see sound, or you'll smell sound, you'll taste sound. The great neurologist Oliver Sacks, who, if you haven't had the pleasure of reading his work, you definitely should. Brilliant, brilliant man, and just a beautiful human being. He's just a great meat sack. He just passed away in 2016. He was a brilliant, brilliant man that took on the most extreme cases in neurology. He studied savants. His first book was I Mistook My Wife for a Hat, and it's the biggest damage to someone's memory. It's been 20 years since I've read it, that we've ever seen. So this gentleman, I believe he was a music teacher in a high school. He played piano and all this stuff. He got a sinus infection, I believe it was, and it went into his brain and caused him to go into a coma. When he woke up from the coma, he could not remember anything about his life prior. He couldn't even remember his own name, and he couldn't retain anything for longer than 30 seconds. His wife stayed with him.
Oh, wow.
His wife stayed with him, even though she had to remind him who she was every 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. But Oliver Sacks, he's an amazing guy, and he wrote a book. The name escapes me right now. It was in the 70s, I believe, that he wrote it. It's about his experimentation with psychedelics, mm-hmm. and he became obsessed with the color indigo. It's a color that we're not supposed to be able to see. And so he decided to eat mushrooms until he could see indigo one day. And it was pretty amazing. It was through a combination of music and mushrooms that he was actually able to experience indigo. And I think he probably experienced indigo more than most of us will ever experience a color.
So I know Van Gogh, he claimed to have synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Van Gogh did a lot of drugs. I know he's known to do absinthe, other things.
Yeah.
I wonder, I don't know how common psychedelics were back then, but this is one of the strangest things. You see, I have two Van Gogh paintings on my wall. He's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Van Gogh, when he painted Starry Night, which is now like the most commercialized painting on the planet, he just painted what he said he saw.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually painted turbulent flow and fluid dynamics. They now know that there's something up there that looks like what he painted.
Yeah.
And that always blows my mind.
Well, he considered himself a realist.
Uh-huh.
Which, if you look at his art, he definitely was not a realist.
No.
So I think he was seeing a little more than what the average person sees.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that ergot in the 1860s in Paris, which was Van Gogh's time.
Yeah.
All the Impressionist painters, which Van Gogh was considered one of the great Impressionists, they were doing ergot, which is the precursor to LSD.
We know
that they were doing a spiked beer of sorts, a spiked ale, it's called. It was the same thing used in the Eleusinian mystery occult in Greece. And what ergot is, it's just a wheat blight. Every so often, the wheat will get this blight and turn disgusting looking. I've seen it. But it's some sort of chemical that's produced from that blight that causes you to hallucinate. The tattoo I actually have on my ribs, and those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music. That is, Friedrich Nietzsche went to Sweden during the ergot festival. So it was a bunch of people that had eaten a bunch of ergot. So the people that were dancing, there was no music playing, but they could all hear it.
Right.
The people that hadn't taken any ergot, they were like, oh, those people are crazy. So that's what that's about. I always felt like I was a crazy person dancing. I could hear the music.
Uh-huh.
So
I love it.
But Van Gogh's in a very interesting character. And the fact that he... killed himself by shooting himself in the chest 3 times and then crawled a mile to his friend's house, the doctor, and died there 2 days later. I'm not so sure it was a suicide.
Yeah.
Definitely not. There's a fantastic book, Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore. Christopher Moore is one of the funniest humans on the planet. He has all the writing chops of John Steinbeck or one of the greats. But he likes to take these very real characters and put them into situations that would never happen to hilarious effect. So Sacre Bleu, what it's about, and it's the first time he went into historical fiction. It's the 1860s Paris. It starts with Van Gogh's death, And he poses that it was a murder, mm-hmm. and he makes a murder mystery out of it. And it's all about painting naked people and doing opium and absinthe, and it's a fantastic romp. It is so much fun. I never thought Christopher Moore could be sexy, but I mean, the impressionist.
Could you write that down? I think I would like to...
I actually have a copy. I'll bring it to you. I have a signed copy, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
But yeah, Christopher Moore's a brilliant, brilliant author. He's one of the funniest humans to ever put pen to paper. But if you're a Van Gogh fan, you should definitely read it. Henry Tolhouse-Lautrec, the father of Art Nouveau, you've seen the absinthe posters with the like vines and the naked women, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen those. That's
yes.
Art Nouveau. Henry Tolhouse-Lautrec is who started that movement.
Okay.
That art style. He actually made most of the absinthe posters in Paris. He was low-level royalty that came from a long line of inbreeding, so he was a dwarf. His legs were in bad pain all the time.
Uh-huh.
He was known for whoring, opium, and absinthe. And he's a wild man, but he's uh-huh. one of the main characters in Sacre Bleu.
I was going to say, it sounds like maybe George R. R. Martin
yeah.
relied heavily on
yeah.
him for
Tyrion is very
yeah.
Henry Tolhouse-Lautrec.
Which,
very.
I mean, Tyrion was... one of the stars, in my opinion.
Yeah, Tyrion...
of the show. Of the book, he was...
Oh,
I don't want to ruin anything,
he
but
was
like,
definitely a star in the book.
He was. I feel he was a weaker character in the book.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. He was my favorite. I read the book years before the show.
Still loved it.
Right.
I read the first book in 2000, and they came out in 98. I read Game of Thrones in 2000, so I've got 20 years with this story.
Right.
And so I had almost 20 years in before the show was
mm-hmm.
even thought of.
Yeah.
And Tyrion's been my spirit animal since 20 years
he's,
ago.
He's a great character, for real. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think they churched him up for the show a little bit.
I don't really feel like he was changed all that much. It's just that Peter Dinklage was such a perfect.
Yes,
he literally
for that
well, and they,
for that he role. Was built for that role.
And mm-hmm. like I think some of the way you look at him versus how they describe him in the book, I think changes maybe some perception, because Peter Dinklage is still an attractive human, whether
yeah.
he be dwarf or not.
Yeah.
And you know, and in the book,
yeah.
you know, Tyrion has like
well,
a,
that they did that with all the characters.
Yes,
they did. They did. It's TV.
They beautified
yeah.
all of
oh,
them.
Yeah.
All of them. Yeah.
yeah.
So, but yeah, definitely a great story. Really reading those books is just learning how to properly hate George R. R. Martin. He loves to kill your favorite characters,
oh, yes.
and he will never finish the story.
Yeah, my sister calls it torture porn.
Yeah, that's
it's like
exactly
I don't do torture porn.
That's exactly what it
her
is.
Writing's very interesting. Is that she's like I don't write evil characters.
Really?
Yeah, because she's like no one's evil. She's like they have their own. Thing.
Well, the best evil characters are the ones you can find common ground
yeah,
with.
The anti-hero.
Yeah, the most. That's what makes a character complex is, and George R. R. Martin, he was fantastic at that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at the first book versus the second and third book. Jaime Lannister is the most hated character
oh,
besides
yes.
Joffrey by
mm-hmm.
the end of the first
yes.
book. And you end up rooting for that guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
He loses his hand and mm-hmm. you end up rooting for him. And that is a sign of fantastic writing.
Yes.
When you can make me hate someone and then simultaneously respect that person and start rooting for him, that's fantastic writing.
Yeah.
And that's realistic writing. Mm-hmm. That's where I hope to get with my writing. I mm-hmm. love to write. Of course, you always want to be able to elicit emotion as a writer, but to be able to change someone's opinion about a character, that's a,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
that's a very deft hand.
So you don't think he'll ever finish it, huh?
No, he's no. pretty much said so. He said I'm bad at deadlines, and there's no reason to finish it. I think it will be finished. I think
yeah.
it'll be D.W. Weiss, or DeBice, whatever, the showrunner,
mm-hmm.
the guy who did all the changes for the show. W.B. DeBice.
I'm not sure.
I think that's his name.
Yeah.
He's already been given permission to write the last
yeah,
two books.
Yeah, that's what happened.
And I think he would actually fix it. He said
so.
He's not going to end it the same way as
mm-hmm.
the show. He got outvoted on how the show ended. Yeah, that was not how he wanted it to end. And
I
he's
was not
already
happy
said
with the ending of the show.
Not no one that was a fan of it was.
Right.
It would have been one thing had they foreshadowed and stuck with the Mad Queen thing,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't.
It just
they
all
abandoned
once.
It.
Yeah.
And they completely abandoned when she goes to the necromancers. She is given a prophecy, and they completely abandon that prophecy. And that's the way it should have ended. There's supposed to be three dragons and three dragon riders. And it didn't happen. And that's the way the books need to.
You think there could be some bitterness, too, from George? He's like, well, you screwed it up. I'm not giving you anything.
Yeah.
And he's getting old.
I just hate to, like, you know, the fans, there was a lot. And you have that kind of, that string of thought when it's like, oh, you've got Daenerys who basically says, I'll do anything to become queen. And they're like, and you're mad that she did everything to become queen. And I'm like, but you're really taking, like, it's like, yes, book one Daenerys to that, yes. Like, I could see that. I'm like, but when you put in all of that growth,
that's taken away her character arc.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And they just didn't foreshadow the Mad Queen thing.
Mm-hmm.
They did in the first book, but we've had four books since then.
And we've had so much happen to her.
Yeah, and so she had evolved as a character. Yes. And she was a much deeper character than what she started out as.
Mm-hmm. And I also, there were some kind of tangents that, like, maybe I missed. Maybe I'm not quite intelligent enough, or, like, I was having a bad day, because most of my books are through audiobook because I drive so much.
Yeah.
Maybe I was a little more distracted. But, like, we have this whole, you know, who is Jon Snow?
Yeah.
Who are his parents? And, like, I feel like we tease on it, and then we do.
Well,
and it's like,
this is the thing with that. So, George R.R. Martin, this is why he's a master writer. So, the whole Jon Snow not knowing his parental figures is a trope. That is cliche as you can get from 1970s high fantasy. There are several tropes in 1970s high fantasy that he took and then shit all over them. And that's why the books work.
Okay.
So one of the biggest tropes in 1970s high fantasy is your main character is always a badass for no given reason.
Uh-huh.
He is always righteous for no given reason. He always chooses the high road. And he doesn't know at least one of his parents.
Okay.
For the big twist. That is the character mm-hmm. of all high fantasy 1970s, all the way through the 80s, really. He took that character in Jon Snow. Jon Snow checked all the boxes mm-hmm. of the most cliche high fantasy character. Then he shit all over it. When he cuts the head off of Janice Slint at the wall, that's when it said, this ain't your normal trope.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I was expecting, because I've read a lot of 1970s and 80s high fantasy, he was going to bring the sword almost down on him and then say, no, it's not worth it, and, like, choose the high road.
Mm-hmm.
No, he cut that motherfucker's head off.
He did.
And that's where you learn what kind of writer George R. R. Martin is. Mm-hmm. He took that trope and shit all over it. And I was like, yes!
Mm-hmm. I guess there was a part about a switching of a baby. And I never quite got, to me, I never thought, did that happen for real? Like,
yeah.
I'm really giving you a very generic description, but, like, I know.
Well, I don't want to run it for
right,
anyone out there.
Right, there were two separate thoughts, parts of swapping babies that I don't think happened in the
well,
show.
Well, it involved, in the book.
Yes.
Eddard Stark's sister plays his relation to Jon Snow, but.
So, yeah. Sorry to get off on that tangent, but and not to ruin Game of Thrones for anybody, I do recommend you watch it. I highly recommend you read and or listen. Roy Dotrice is the person that reads the audiobooks.
Yeah, he does fantastic.
All of them but one. Stick it out on number four. I believe Roy Dotrice does not read number four. Stick it out.
He comes back.
But Roy Dotrice is actually a world record holder for the amount of voices he gives his characters in his reading of his audiobook.
So it's kind of interesting, too, your theory that they've already picked the secondary author for mm-hmm. the Game of Thrones books. This exact same thing happened for the Jesse Stone novels,
mm-hmm.
where Robert Parker was writing these books, and he passed away kind of unexpectedly. I think he was actually in the middle of one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Reed Coleman take over.
Yeah.
He writes now, but my sister and I had a long talk about this. I noticed, like, hey, these books have gotten weird. Like, there's, like, very few words on a page. And she said they're screenplays.
Yeah.
They're screenplays that they've turned into novels instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
So Parker
you
had a depth
that a
that's not there.
George R. R. Martin had been trained since the early 80s to get a show.
Uh-huh.
Game of Thrones, that idea, it was originally to be a show. He didn't want to write these big, long novels. He thought it was too much work.
Right.
That's why he's not ever going to finish them. He never intended to write them.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted it to be a show.
Yeah.
And he finally succeeded
the
in that.
The show's done.
Yeah, so why would he? But that's happened several times. Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
yep.
his five-part trilogy, those were taken over. There's 10 or 12 books now
mm-hmm.
By someone else. Roger Zelazny, if you've never read it, he is widely considered the grandfather of modern fantasy. He wrote this 10-book series from like 1979 to 1993 or 4 called the Nine Princes and Amber series, and it is mind-blowing. You see its footprints everywhere. Without that book, there'd be no Matrix. Without that book, there would be... I could give a list. There would be no Game of Thrones. He changed the way we view modern fantasy. He took high fantasy and tore it apart and said, I can do better. And he did. It's amazing. By the end of it, all I gotta tell you is machine guns and manticores.
Okay.
What was the name of that book?
It's called Nine Princes and Amber. There's 10 books, and they are... But he died right after the 10th book was written. Many people speculated that he wasn't finished because it kind of leaves it open-ended in the 10th book. Well, they tried to find someone to finish it, but finally his estate said, no, we would rather keep it as is than have someone potentially ruin it.
Right.
And they are pretty perfect. Very intense, very high-paced, which we never saw in high fantasy before. We never saw high pace, high tension, just really strong, fast-paced writing. And that's what Roger Zelazny came along and did. He changed the way we look at fantasy. That it could be dark, it could be gritty, it could be fast, it could be... It could have machine guns and manticores.
Yeah.
I'm game.
I would love to see a series come of that. It would make... It'd probably make Game of Thrones look like a Disney production.
And that would be amazing, and I would like to see that.
It's not quite as dark as Game of Thrones, but it's every bit as badass. But yeah, that's my fantasy rant there.
That's good. Well, this is all dream fuel, you know, when you think about it. Like,
oh, yeah. For real.
And it's funny because that book, Nine Princes Amber, actually starts with a guy waking up from a coma, and he's had this dream about a former life. And that's where it starts.
There you go.
Oh, wow.
He knows that every June 14th someone tries to kill him. And it is June 14th.
Mm-hmm.
And he has
idea
why.
I would like to start this book tonight.
We'll get it.
It is almost June 14th.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
It's an amazing book. So
it's interesting that the whole dream concept just ripples through time.
It really does.
I mean, we've covered a long way here.
Yeah.
And then you've got the people that have the dream through the coma. Like,
Ozzy Osbourne.
It's like, well, like I was telling you with the Mars Volta, they have Dreams of the Comatorium. I don't remember the name of the album. But it's literally about their friend was in a car wreck, was in a medically induced coma, woke up and kicked the window out of his 4-story hospital window and dove out of it. Yeah. Literally had been awake from his coma for 30 seconds immediately wanted to die. And Brian, when I told him that, he brought up an interesting point. Because I was like, what happened in that dream that you'd instantly want to die? He's like, well, he's probably trying to get back to where he was. It was probably amazing.
Probably.
he probably was in heaven, or he learned to fly or something like Brian was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And his reality had become better. And dreams bring up a lot of questions about perception, proprioception, how we view our body in space and time, how we are umwelt, how our sensory perception creates our reality. And we've all had those dreams where when we wake up from them, we were just standing and now we're laying down.
Mm-hmm.
And it throws our proprioception off and we don't know where we're at or who we are for a second.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of an amazing thing. It's kind of a reality within a reality within a reality. I've had dreams about dreaming before.
That's interesting.
I mean, yeah, how deep can that go?
Yeah.
I mean, you take two mirrors and face each other in a hallway.
And they go forever.
They go for it. It's the infinite mirror. So, it's dreams can do the same. So.
Well, hopefully this is some dream fuel for our people.
Yeah, hopefully we've inspired you guys to think deeply this week about dreams. And I do recommend, I did it all through my teen years, dream journaling, if you can be consistent with it.
Yep.
They recommend just keep a notepad next to your bed and just in the dark without flipping on a light before you've even really opened your eyes, grab the pen and just write down keywords.
Yep.
Those keywords, when read later, will trigger what you were experiencing. And it's a good way to track your dreams. The thing I noticed through my dream journaling, I dream journaled from like 16 to 22, and I noticed that almost all of my dreams, not all, but almost, all my normal day-to-day dreams took place in 5 locations. And some of those locations didn't exist in reality, but they were reoccurring locations in my head. And which is odd because they weren't the same dreams. They're just same location. And so I would like to hear back from you guys. Do you guys dream in the same locations? Because that would make sense. You're going to the same places in your head each night.
I can't say from my dreaming that I know the concept of what you're saying. I would be in the same place, but every now and then it would be different. There would be different rooms. It would be bigger.
That's how mine was. One of mine was a real place. It was my grandmother's house, but it would have secret doorways and extra rooms, and sometimes in a whole extra part of the house that didn't exist in reality.
A gymnasium attached, a pool, things
just
like
crazy
that.
Stuff. Sometimes it'd be connected to a school. Like all of a sudden I'm in grandma's house.
You just
house.
Walk right through.
Yeah, walk through to the middle school or something. And there's reoccurring locations there, but they can evolve and change. I think that's kind of interesting.
As an adult, I think I don't have reoccurring dreams, but I have reoccurring themes. So as an adult, I've noticed it's never the same situation, the same place, the same really anything other than I'll be weak. I'll go to fight somebody. So the reason's different. Like sometimes it might be for self-preservation. Sometimes it might be because I'm angry and I want to start violence. Sometimes it's that, you know, I've got to hit this person to keep myself safe. But the reoccurring theme is always I go to throw the punch and it's like I can barely lift my arm.
That's a common
and
theme.
And I make contact and it's like a touch. Or I go to run, and I give it my all, and I'm like three, and it's like running in that slow motion quicksand, and I'm just running as hard as I can, and I get 3 steps, and I just have to lay down, and I'm just like, I can't go. Yeah. I can't go anymore.
Those are fairly common. I've had many friends tell me about similar dreams. A lot of my friends, a lot of my male friends in particular, I've noticed have goal-oriented dreams where they have to do this task in their dream. And if they don't accomplish the task, there'll be dire consequences. And I don't have dreams like that. Mine are very surreal and hard to explain. I don't think I dream in a typical fashion for the most part. Most of my dreams, if I was to explain them to you, you'd be like, whoa, what did you take before bed?
No, it's just permanent now.
This is how it works. I opened up some gateways that never closed.
I don't really feel like I have profound dreams. I have some pretty wacky ones. One as an adult was, and so this is me and 4 coworkers of my current job that were not connected at all. So they were people that I had worked with in different areas of my same job that had never met. Mm-hmm. So we are the newest police deputies for our county. We show up for work at the same, like first day work for all 4 of us, same day. Basically, we're standing around. We don't really know what we're doing. We're all in our deputy uniform. And I remember thinking like, God, we look so cool. Like we're like in this official uniform and they give us a Jeep. Like we have this, it was like a Wrangler. And I'm like, holy cow, like our police vehicle's a Jeep and we all 4 get a ride together. It was like, this is the best job ever. So then they're like, hey, there's an accident, get out there. And we're like, we look at each other like, did you receive any like on the job training? And they're like, no, they just told me to show up in uniform today. And I was like, okay, me neither. So we go to this accident site. I remember like one of my coworkers is trying to get a statement. And I remember them being like, ma'am, you're going to have to calm down and talk to me so I can get this statement so I can leave. And me and like 2 others are trying to figure out how we can take this, like these green vines, and make rope. Because for some reason we need to have rope at this accident scene, and we've got to make it out of this vine.
Wow.
So me and another coworker are doing this, and then we're randomly looking around and we're all like, hey, did they ever tell us like when lunch is? Yeah. And like that's a conversation, is that no one told us if we get a lunch break or not.
Wow.
And basically I woke up and I was just like, that was a dream.
That's an odd dream.
I have one that very vividly sticks out. I actually talked to you about this. I have to start writing. I have not done it, but I've talked to a good friend of mine about this. We actually hashed this out a little bit. But I did have a dream that was the opposite. I've had the dreams where you punch someone and it's like nothing. You know, it's like you can't harm that person in your dream.
Yeah.
This one was the opposite. I was actually a character in my own story. Yeah. And in this, we're a security force in the future where everything's privatized. And we'd been hired to do something. And I remember some guys tried to block me in a store in this dream. My character. I'm dreaming as a character. And I stabbed one of the guys in the bicep in the chest. And I said, he'll probably make it. And then I walked out and said, or not. And I woke up from that. And I was like, God,
that's like a cheesy cop line.
It was perfect, man.
That's
man.
Either,
what did I watch? What did
he'll
I do?
Either make it down
or not. Or not. You feel like.
Can like Dolph Lundgren say that in like that's the movie hilarious. Adaptation?
Maybe. I mean,
he
you
dies,
never know.
If you ever need any help writing, I write prolifically.
I know. I'm very envious of that.
I write constantly. Yeah. So I would lost my mind years ago if I didn't write.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think we're gonna pull some of those writings out of you one day.
Maybe
for the show. Maybe.
Like I said, I would much rather strangers read my writing than people I actually respect.
We just have to pretend like we don't know any of these people. Yeah. So, all right, man. I think we're good for today.
I think it's a wrap.
I think so.
Dreams have been dived. So
they have. Yeah, we'll definitely revisit this. I'm sure we'll probably all dream tonight.
Well, and I think it's probably going to be worthy of a revisit when our amazing audience full of throwaway kids gives us their input of what their reoccurring dreams are and what their theories are about the dreams. So definitely let us know. Use that Facebook page, guys, and stay in contact with us so that way we can make this a part two, hopefully.
Yep.
We are going to be making a post soon about a future episode. We want your input, and the best of which we'll get talked about on the air here.
Yeah.
So we will be putting together a Facebook post in the next couple days. Yep. We're not exactly sure on timeline when we'll be doing this episode, but we definitely want to get you guys interacting, and we want to start telling some of your all stories here on the air.
Yes, absolutely. And being the local tech guy, we are now on Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm working on getting a WordPress actual website set up for us.
Nice.
So I make no promises.
Yeah.
I'm a busy man, but I'm definitely putting a lot into this. So.
Oh, and to our listener in Germany, thank you so much. And please share with your friends.
I hope you hear this.
Yes.
Yeah, share it around. Yeah. So, all right, everyone. Have a great evening.
Yep. Keep diving.
Yep.